And in the book, I talked about the characters that are in there, and when the book begins to really bring up stuff that pertains to the Bible is when this man by the name of Lee Teabing is introduced. And in the book, he explains the real nature of Christ to this lady in the book named Sophie in his drawing room, and he points out that even though the Gospels of the New Testament portray Jesus as divine, which they do, and not human, now we know the Gospels portray Jesus Christ as both human and divine. So that statement that the Gospels present him as human and not as divine and not human isn't accurate at all. He points out that there were other Gospels from early Christianity that provide a more historically accurate portrayal in which Jesus is seen as human. So what he's making in that statement is that the portrayal of Jesus Christ in the Bible isn't accurate. It's a skewed view, is the point we'll see he's making. And he says these Gospels that he mentioned, these other Gospels, are found among the Dead Sea Scrolls and the documents found at Nag Hammadi in Egypt. So he's saying that we have these four Gospels, but those four Gospels don't really give you the picture of Christ. If you want to really understand the true Christ, you need to look at these other Gospels, which are found in the Dead Sea Scrolls and these scrolls from Egypt. These, he indicates, are among the earliest surviving gospel accounts of Jesus Christ and can be used to correct the biblical view of him as divine, because he feels the biblical view is incorrect. The question that we want to look at here today is, are these assertions about the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi Library true? That's what they call it, the Nag Hammadi Library. It's not a building. It's a series of books that they found, and we'll talk about them a little bit more as we go through. So are his assertions true, or are they parts of the fiction of the Da Vinci Code? Consider Teabing's words to Sophie. He said, "Fortunately for historians," Teabing said, "some of the Gospels that Constantine attempted to eradicate managed to survive. The Dead Sea Scrolls were found in the 1950s hidden in a cave near Qumran in the Judean desert. And, of course, the Coptic Scrolls in 1945 at Nag Hammadi. In addition to telling the true Grail story, these documents speak of Christ's ministry in very human terms. Of course, the Vatican, in keeping with their tradition of misinformation, tried very hard to suppress the release of these scrolls." Now, are these things historically accurate? Well, we'll see that there are a number of flaws in those statements. As we'll see later, Constantine didn't attempt to eradicate any of the earlier Gospels. Secondly, the Dead Scrolls don't contain any Gospels. There are no Gospels at all in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947, not in the 50s. The Coptic documents at Nag Hammadi were in book form. They were not scrolls. So when they found these are actually books, not scrolls. Neither what was found at Nag Hammadi nor the Dead Sea Scrolls ever speak of the Grail story, this idea of the Holy Grail. Nor do they speak of Jesus' ministry in very human terms. In fact, if you look at the books that were found at Nag Hammadi, they speak of basically this very spiritual Jesus, not a human Jesus. The Vatican had nothing to do with covering up either of these discoveries. Now, the Vatican is guilty of covering things up and being misleading, but not in this case. So where you're guilty. Where you're not, we can't blame it on you. The Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi Library were important historical finds, but they have minimal impact upon us as Christians. So really, you know what? If they'd never been found, it wouldn't have mattered. Because you have the Bible, then you don't need them. But we'll see, it is interesting to consider what's in there, because people will make assertions about them, and you can understand, okay, what are these things, and what impact do they have on us as Christians? And so we're going to talk about these two bodies of literature that have been found and begin with the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls were the most significant discovery of manuscripts in modern times, and they were discovered purely by luck. There was a young boy in 1947. He was out with his flock of sheep and goats, and he was watering them at a spring in the Judean desert near the ancient ruins of a place called Qumran, which is near the Dead Sea. And in this location, Qumran is about 7 miles south of Jericho and about 12 miles east of Jerusalem. And one of his flock was missing. So he's looking for the missing member of his flock. And he saw a cave above him and tossed a rock inside. And when he threw the rock inside, he hears this plink. And he thinks, what's that? Obviously, there's something in there. So he doesn't go in there that day. He goes back home and he gets a friend. I wouldn't go into a cave by myself. And so he goes and gets a friend and to investigate. And when they go inside, they find large earthenware jars with intact scrolls inside. And these scrolls were wrapped in linen. The jars contained 7 complete scrolls. And once they found these, they thought, these might be valuable. So there was a series of sales, various scrolls sold to different parties. And eventually the state of Israel bought all of these scrolls in 1955. And with the discovery of the these scrolls, the Bedouins who were living in this area and had their flocks out in this area and trained archaeologists began searching the caves in the area, and there were about 300 caves around this area of Qumran, and they began doing this in the 50s, and they found that 11 of these 300 caves contained manuscripts. Most of the manuscripts they found weren't intact as the original 7, but they found fragments in each of the caves. For instance, in Cave 4, which is the fourth cave in which manuscripts were discovered, they found that it was full of manuscripts that had deteriorated over time. So they found 15,000 scraps in this room. And so what they did was they meticulously took all these scraps and they put them back together. So you can imagine somebody sitting there with these little scraps, you know, and putting them together like a jigsaw puzzle, you know, with tweezers, and they're handling them very carefully, but they did put them back together. And so you find pieces of different manuscripts. They figure there were about 600 manuscripts there originally, but they're only pieces of the manuscripts that have survived. The finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls is highly significant because it provides us with crucial information about what was happening in Judaism in the centuries just before and after the beginning of Christianity. So these scrolls have to do with Judaism, and they are not Christian. They are Judaic. And they're significant for the understanding of Christianity in the sense that they show you what things were like as Christianity developed. So Christ comes on the scene, Christianity begins. So what was the Judaic world like at that time? And by looking at these scrolls, we can understand better what that historical period was like. As you think about the content of the scrolls, as they are Jewish, there are no Christian documents among them. Because they're not Christian. They were written by, all the texts are Jewish. They were made by Jews. They were copied by Jews. And they were used by Jews between the period of about 150 B.C. on through about 70 A.D. Now, there are certain benefits to the scrolls, as I've mentioned. Among the scrolls were biblical text and related commentaries, as well as these groups that were there were religious sects of the Jews. And they had their own internal writings addressing the issues that were important to them. Most likely the group that was there was known as the Essenes. The Essenes, which were a group that I believe was celibate, and they had certain very strict laws and those kinds of things. And over time, being celibate, they died out. But they were quite influential for a period there. Other texts that they had were found among these the Dead Sea Scrolls were what you would classify as quasi-biblical writings, such as the Book of Jubilees and the Book of Enoch, which in their time had quite wide audiences, but they're not biblical books. They relate to the Bible, but they're not biblical. The material also included correspondence and legal documents relating to, for example, to various agreements that people made. Because they comprised material in various languages, the scrolls also added a lot of understanding of the languages of the time: Aramaic, Hebrew, and Greek. And the recovery of the Hebrew documents greatly increased modern knowledge of that language, which people prior to that primarily had to rely upon the biblical text. And that's how they understood Hebrew. But with these, it added some insight into the scriptures. The discovery of so many scrolls and fragments relating to the scriptures has also highlighted how the people of that day understood the sacred writings. Among the sectarian scrolls, quotes from certain scriptural books such as Deuteronomy and Isaiah and Psalms were dominant. Also, they thought highly of the book of Daniel. Significantly, the Gospels and the Apostolic writings, on what did they rely? Didn't they look back to the Old Testament? Didn't they rely upon Isaiah? Many quotes in the New Testament from Isaiah. And they looked to the law and the prophets. They looked back to the Old Testament, and that was the foundation on which they built. The sectarian parts of that, that means the things that pertain to this particular sect of Jews, the Essenes, have testified to the intensity of religious feelings that existed in earlier Jewish times. Have we ever felt strongly about religious ideas in our time? I'd say we have. Okay, we have strong opinions about this or that, don't we? And sometimes we disagree. And they did back then too. So that was the way it was. And so we've been able to have a growing understanding of the society into which the early church was born. They have shown the religious community of that period to be highly polarized on many subjects, including the temple. What's the significance of the temple? And the calendar. Is that an issue today? Oh, yeah, it is, among many groups. So they were fighting over the calendar back in that time. And guess what? Here we are 2,000 years later, still fighting about it. So when Christ comes, thankfully that will be settled. And but we tend to have our opinions about these things and sometimes can't see eye to eye. And they were having difficulty with that as well. Religious behavior was apparently a divisive force in that time, and we know that it can be at times in our time. Among the most significant documents in the Dead Sea Scrolls are copies of the Hebrew Bible, what we would know as the Old Testament. Some of these copies are nearly complete. For example, one of the original seven scrolls that they found in Cave 1 is a scroll that has is a scroll of the prophet Isaiah. And as they've gone through the Dead Sea Scrolls, they found that every book of the Hebrew Bible is represented among the manuscripts that they found in the 11 caves, except for the book of Esther. It's the only one that's not mentioned. And this discovery of biblical manuscripts is significant because prior to this, our oldest copy of the Hebrew Bible came from about 1000 A.D. That was the oldest copy of the Old Testament. Now, why is that? Does anybody recollect why we had, you know, the Bible supposedly goes back to about a long ways back when the 1400s B.C. when Moses was writing, and yet we only have a copy from 1000 A.D. Does anybody recollect why? The reason is, once a copy wore out, what did you do with it? You recopied it and you threw it away. And so you didn't keep these old copies. So that's why you don't have... they were very carefully copied it, and then they would discard the old copy. And so they found these older copies of Bible, and very positive results have come from it. So what we've found as a result of going back and looking at these manuscripts from the Dead Sea Scrolls, we find that the Old Testament that we have is accurate. They all go together. What you find in these caves, which are these old manuscripts, the texts all line up with one another. So with regard to the canonization of Scripture, the collection we know as the Old Testament is now understood to be the product of Jewish efforts rather than something imposed on Judaism. So in creating what we know as the Bible, the Gospels and the Apostolic writings, the church was simply adding to what was already there and had authority. So with the Dead Sea Scrolls, is the most positive thing that comes out of it. As you look at it, you look at the Old Testament and you compare the scrolls to the Old Testament, you see, wow, it's pretty much word for word the same. And it shows that the Bible, as we know it, had already come down to them in that form at that time and had been preserved. And it's a reinforcement of the authenticity of the Bible and the authority of the Bible. So when you think of the Dead Sea Scrolls, when you see it said in the Da Vinci Code that the Dead Sea Scrolls contain these ancient Gospels, they don't. They're Jewish writings and have nothing to do with the Gospels other than giving us the background of the Gospels. Now, so that gives us an idea about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now we're going to talk about the Nag Hammadi Library. In the Da Vinci Code, the statement is made that the Nag Hammadi and Dead Sea Scrolls are the earliest Christian writings. As we've already seen, that's not the case with the Dead Sea Scrolls. But the Nag Hammadi writings contain both Gnostic and what we consider as false Christian writings. Okay, so scholars may think they're Christian writings, and they may have people that were nominal Christians writing them, but they were primarily Gnostic Christians. And we'll talk about a little bit about Gnosticism today. Now, how were these discovered? They were discovered by luck as well. You had a group of men in Upper Egypt, which Upper Egypt, if you look at a map, north is at the top. And you consider Upper Egypt the top, wouldn't you? Well, that's not how it works. It relates to the flow of the Nile. The area, the closer to its origin is Upper Egypt. The area down at where the Nile empties into the Mediterranean is Lower Egypt. So these men were about 40 miles from a place called Luxor, where you have all the monuments that are pretty famous, the temple at Luxor. And what they were doing is they were at a cliff, and they were digging out fertilizer. There were certain minerals and things there that were good for crops. And so they were there digging this fertilizer and then carting it back to their homes and putting it on their fields. Well, in the process of digging this fertilizer out, somebody had his pick, and he plunged his pick in, and he hit a skeleton. So then they thought, okay, so they dug the skeleton out, and then they kept digging, and they found earthenware jars that contained some of these manuscripts. So the books, and as they found these manuscripts, and eventually these books went through a process of sales and back and forth, and eventually they ended up in the Coptic Museum in Cairo. And so what was this ancient collection of books? The short answer is that it is the most significant collection of lost so-called Christian writings to turn up in modern times. They found a total of 46 different treatises, most of them previously unknown. It included several Gospels about Jesus that had never been seen by any Western scholar, and these books bring us into contact with Gnosticism. And so we're going to talk about Gnosticism a little bit, because that's basically the orientation from which these books were written. So until the last few decades, all we knew about Gnosticism came to us through the disputations of writers between the 2nd and 4th century. So Gnosticism was a challenge to the church. And Gnosticism was a problem that various what are called church fathers recognized and addressed. And so from looking at their writings, we can see, hey, there were Gnostics and they were a problem to the early church. And then as time has gone along, we found various Gnostic writings in different places. And the most significant find was these books that they found at Nag Hammadi in the desert in the 1940s. So these Gnostic influences are part of the Da Vinci Code. He's brought them in there and said that these are more authentic gospels that give us a better view of Jesus Christ, a better understanding of Jesus Christ. And we'll see if that's the case. The term Gnosticism was apparently coined only in the 17th century. You knew about Gnostics, but the term Gnosticism came into use at that time. The movement appears to follow the reverse path of the early church. Jesus Christ called his disciples, who were originally not Christians, but were called and added to the church, and they came from many of the country areas in Galilee and Judea. And then after his death, what happened? They were sent out to the urban areas to preach the gospel, spread throughout the world preaching the gospel. Well, Gnosticism went the other way. It started in the great urban centers, and then they went out into the desert. So they went the opposite direction. So they went out there to contemplate this great knowledge that they had come to. They went out into the desert and began to reflect on these supposed insights that they had been given. So you find a lot of these people out in the desert in Egypt and places like that. So Gnosticism, what does it owe its basic premises to? Well, it primarily owes its basic ideas to philosophy. Officially, it began in the 2nd century and lasted within the Roman Empire until its ban in the 5th century. But in reality, it is alive and well even to this day. Gnosticism exists today. And Gnosticism is something that changes and morphs as time goes along. The true origins of the Gnostics are difficult to establish for the simple reason that the movement never tried to chart its history. And perhaps they attempted to establish their legitimacy on the premise that they had existed from time immemorial. From another perspective, having their origins shrouded in mystery tended to support their central belief that Gnosticism was a religion based on revelation and hidden spiritual knowledge resulting in special insight. Now, does that sound like Christianity to a degree? Doesn't true Christianity, isn't it based on revelation? Didn't we say that without revelation, people cast off restraint? And doesn't it involve hidden spiritual knowledge in the sense that God has to open your mind to spiritual truth? And you need special insight, which God's Spirit gives you. So there are ways in which this would appeal to a human being, something special, these mysteries that are offered by Gnosticism. And you know how Satan is. Satan tries to duplicate the truth, and he tries to appeal to man in a way that is going to most effectively impact them. So Gnosticism didn't need a history of its own, because if they had that type of history, it would reduce its followers to the level of any other religious convert. According to the Gnostic sources, knowledge was given in the earliest days of human history, only to remain hidden from most until the last days. Does that have a ring of truth to it? It's interesting to examine the writings of the Gnostics considered holy. This is where the Nag Hammadi library comes in. No book, as you look at the Nag Hammadi library, no book of the Hebrew Scriptures was found among these writings. So there is no book of the Old Testament found there. And that's significant and basically gives you an indication of where they stand as far as how they look at the Old Testament. The Old Testament is rejected. Though the Nag Hammadi collection did include works that rewrote and interpreted the creation account from the early chapters of Genesis, they did that. And they also looked back to pre-flood characters such as Seth. The clear implication of the Gnostics is that Gnosticism had existed since the creation of humanity. Do you think Gnosticism has existed since the creation of humanity? Yeah, it has. But what was the origin of that? You know, Satan's been around since then, hasn't it? And these ideas were in his head. Now, also the find didn't include any book that appears in the New Testament. You know, as you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, you find various books of the Old Testament. But when you look at the Nag Hammadi library, there are no books of the New Testament. Numerous Gospels are attributed to individuals who appear in the New Testament, but these Gospels are of a completely different type. They relate not to the life and teachings of Jesus Christ, but only to his purported sayings as recorded by those who the Gnostics claimed possessed specially revealed knowledge from him. So these writers of these Gnostic books say, I was with Christ, and this is what he said. So they're using Christ to get across a particular philosophy and using Christ as an authority to back it up. Rather than the practicality that is the hallmark of the Bible. You know, when you think about the Bible, it's practical, isn't it? It tells you, here's how to live. And this is not these writings are not practical that you find from the Gnostics. They involve mythic themes, and it's not a practical writing. At the time when the movement was becoming firmly established, many people believed that they were living in the last days of civilization. And the growing popularity of the Gnostics was understandable. They were self-proclaimed chosen people and recipients of true knowledge or insight. And so you have a number of books that are called apocalypses. Do we have an apocalypse in the Bible? Yeah, we do. It's called the Apocalypse of St. John the Divine, probably in your Bible. It's not how we would know it. We know it as the apocalypse of Jesus Christ, because he's the one who's revealing that knowledge. It happened to be written down by John, but it's an apocalypse. And so they had apocalyptic literature too. They're very different from the book of Revelation. Because when you look at the book of Revelation, does it tie back at all to the Old Testament? How about the fact that there are going to be 144,000 from where? From the tribes of Israel. Isn't that what it says? And you see all these allusions back to the Old Testament in the book of Revelation. And you see that all the way through the New Testament. So understanding the Gnostic apocalypses depended solely on mystic insight. Now, notable among the works found in one particular codex of the Nag Hammadi Library was a copy of Plato's Republic. Now, why would they have Plato's Republic in there among these books? The reason is because they felt Plato's Republic was important to read. And it was important to your understanding of their particular philosophy. And, you know, this was fundamental to who and what they were. Now, if you've ever tried, I remember in college we had to read portions of Plato. It's difficult to understand. It's confusing. And if you want to see where philosophy leads you, you only have to go back and listen to Dr. Stavronides' tapes again. Okay? I'm telling you, if you want to go back and be confused, go back and listen to that stuff. And that's basically where philosophy leads you. It sounds real high and mighty, but it leads you astray. And it's confusing. And you're operating purely upon human reasoning. And sorry, that won't get you where you want to go. You need the revelation that comes from God. So, not Plato was part of it, was something that they based their philosophy upon. The Gnostic interpretation of Scripture was designed to appeal to the Hellenistic intellectual that existed in Alexandria, Egypt. They didn't relate to the New Testament gospel as it presented a world, which was in opposition to the philosophical constructs of Hellenistic culture. You see, remember, have you ever noticed that there has been an anti-Jewish or anti-Hebrew position that many people took? The Jews killed Christ. All of this Jewish stuff, we don't want to be Jewish. You remember that? They talked about those people who were Sabbath keepers as Judaizing. Where did that come from? Well, it came from, a part of it came from this philosophical approach which rejected the Old Testament. So, in fact, Paul talks about it some in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. It says, where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? You know, God, as I've said a number of times, wants to be known. And he's not tried to hide himself. That's not in the way he wrote the Bible. He's not trying to hide himself from us. So when God tells you that He created the world, and it said created in our image, it tells you there's got to be more than one. And he reveals certain things about himself which are pretty clear, and it doesn't involve intellectual constructs, philosophical constructs. It doesn't need that. God reveals himself, and you can take the word of God at face value. Verse 21, for since in the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom did not know God, you cannot, through intellectual exercises, come to know God. Can't do it. It's not going to happen. Now, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't exercise our intellects. It just means we don't want to be carried away, which people that get involved in philosophy sometimes do. So, it pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For Jews request a sign, and Greeks seek after wisdom. That's the Greek approach to things. Jews want a sign, the Greeks want wisdom. The study of the Greek philosopher Plato was well established in Alexandria, and the Gnostics built on this tradition. And a man by the name of Philo was a Jew, and he sought to reconcile his Jewish background in the Old Testament with philosophy. And so what he tried to do is interpret things through allegories and all of this in order to try to reconcile the two. And you may say, well, did the Gnostics influence the Catholic Church? They sure did. That's exactly how the Catholic Church interprets much of the Old Testament. They look at it as allegory and try to bring in all of these allegorical ideas. And where does that come from? It comes from Plato. So the Gnostics did influence that church and still do influence it. And so we look at these early church writers, and they came from a Greek philosophical background. And as they came into contact with the Bible, they began to interpret the Bible philosophically. Because that's how you're going to interpret it. What we have to do as we interpret the Bible is we have to ask God to open our minds to interpret it in a straightforward manner. Okay, this is what it says. This is what it means. And we don't want to bring any extraneous things into it. We want God to lead us to a clear understanding of it, don't we? So we don't have to go to Plato and read the Republic or any of the other things there in order to, and then bring that in and use it to understand the Scriptures. We need God's Spirit, and God's Spirit leading us can help us to come to an understanding of the Bible. Now, from the Nag Hammadi Library, one can begin to understand some aspects of the Gnostic perspective. As I said, they adopted the Hebraic Genesis account rather than adopting the creation account of another group of people. But there, the connection to any form of Hebraic thinking stops. They rejected the thinking of that God inspired Israel to come to and record for us. Having modified the account to change the identity of the Creator and the circumstances of His work, as well as what happened in the Garden of Eden, the Gnostics proceeded to reject the entire historical basis for the Hebrew people and the involvement of God, of the God of Israel, in history. They rejected all of that. So, do we reject that? Absolutely not. We see the whole flow of this. And once you reject that underpinning, where are you at? You have no place. You have no foundation. You've rejected your very foundation. Several of the Gnostic writings contain statements against those who are described in the Bible as the servants of God. For instance, they reject Moses. They reject the prophets. They reject John the Baptist. Do we reject them? Absolutely not. It's as though an attempt is being made to undermine the whole Hebraic component in history, a component that is essential to both the Old and New Testaments. You see, you need the whole book, and you need to understand it all within the context of the whole book. The same could be said of Gnostic equivalents of the New Testament. Gone are any Gospels that portray a Judean or Galilean setting. Instead, we have philosophy based on dualistic Platonic ideas. Does anybody know what dualism means? Dualism means two. Everything is divided into good and evil. Good and evil, okay? That's the fundamental to these philosophical ideas. The statements and personalities drawn from the Gospels and other writings in the New Testament are interpreted spiritually and allegorically, using this purpose, the categories of Greek and Greek philosophy. Now, how could what you find here is they adopted certain ideas and they come up with a set of beliefs and they reject anything that we would consider Hebraic or Jewish. Now, where did this come from? Did the Jews bring this about? Some people have blamed the Jews. However, the Jews did not reject their foundation. Now, they were interested in philosophy, but they did not reject their whole history and God's interaction with them throughout that history. So where did it come from? One of the chief culprits that comes on the scene and does introduce Gnostic ideas and had a tremendous influence on this Gnostic influence on the church was a man by the name of Simon Magus. Simon Magus. While his role as the actual founder of Gnosticism is debated, the biblical book that we know as Acts characterizes him as a Samaritan miracle worker who deceived the people into accepting his claim that he was the great power of God. And it's interesting, something that I'd never thought of before. Let's go to Acts chapter 8 and look at verse 20. Now, maybe over my years in the church, this has come out, but just in looking at this, it jumps out at you again. And it's a tie-in from what we see here in Acts 8:20 in regard to Simon Magus, and it goes all the way back into the Old Testament. Acts 8, verse 20. But Peter said to him, "Your money perish with you because you thought that the gift of God, that is God's Spirit, could be purchased with money. You have neither part nor portion in this matter, for your heart is not right in the sight of God. Repent, therefore, of this your wickedness and pray God if perhaps the thought of your heart may be forgiven you." So Simon Magus, he was baptized, but he just got wet. He never received God's Spirit. And in fact, as they examined him more closely, they saw his whole approach was just radically wrong. Now, is there any other incident in the Old Testament where this a similar situation takes place? Let's go back to Ezra chapter 4. Ezra chapter 4. Now, this is in the context of God's work being reestablished after the the fall of the Jews to Babylon. So they're coming back into the land of promise. They're beginning again. And it's interesting what it is said here. Ezra chapter 4, verse 3. And he's speaking to the surrounding peoples there. And in verse 3 it says, "But Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the rest of the heads of the fathers' houses of Israel said to them, 'You may do nothing with us to build a house for our God. But we alone will build the Lord God of Israel as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us.'" He's saying, "You have no part in this." And didn't they want to participate? And he said they have no part. And you go back to Nehemiah chapter 2. Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 20. And again, the surrounding peoples here want to help out. And Nehemiah says here, "The God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build. But you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem." Sound similar to what was said to Simon Magus? Now, we know that Simon Magus was from a place called Samaria, and we know that at one time that had been occupied by the northern kingdom. They had been carried into captivity, and after they were carried into captivity, what happened? They brought in other people. They brought in other people to inhabit the area of Samaria and portions of the northern kingdom. The immigrants blended their own beliefs, their own pagan beliefs, with the religion of the Israelites, which they learned from an Israelite priest who was sent back to Samaria to instruct them. And when the Jews returned from their own captivity in Babylon in the 6th century, they came up against the now well-known Samaritans with their blended religion. So the Bible portrays their relationship as difficult. They had problems all the time. Remember what happened with the Good Samaritan? Remember everybody walked by them? Because they despised the Samaritans. And they had all kinds of problems, and it was an ongoing dispute. The Jews revered Jerusalem with its temple, while the Samaritans claimed Mount Gerizim as the superior place for worshiping God, especially as they claimed to possess the original version of the Torah. In the late 2nd century, the Jewish king Hyrcanus and his sons destroyed the Samaritans' temple and capital city. Nevertheless, they continued to have difficulties between the Samaritans and the Jews. The Samaritans willingly accepted the Hellenistic ideas that were put forth by the Seleucids, and because they were flexible. They had this blended religion, so they are willing to change with whatever change was necessary. Okay, so we'll just change. Okay, you want us to do this? Well, we'll do that. And they are willing to blend their religion and make it work however it wants to work. That's why even today you can have the Roman, probably several hundred years ago, as the Roman Catholics came to colonize the New World, as they would enter into cities and these cities would have certain celebrations, they would just morph that celebration. "We're not going to take your celebration away. We'll just do a little substituting. So instead of that statue of whatever God you are worshiping, we'll put Jesus in there or Mary. Hey, that's good for us." And everybody's real happy. But God said, "Sorry, that's not going to get it. You can't blend religion," but they're more than willing to do that. So the Samaritans tended not to have a fixed identity, whereas the Jews had a fixed identity so deeply ingrained through history that they strove to avoid the imprint of Greek civilization. And so it's thought that Simon Magus was instrumental in bringing in these Gnostic ideas and propagating that particular religion. When Peter and John totally rejected Simon Magus, the precedent was set for John's reaction to another man by the name of Cerinthus. And that's the story where John is in Ephesus and John goes into the bath he's there with Polycarp, and there's this man named Cerinthus in there. And John said, we need to get out of here. He said, let us fly, lest even the bathhouse fall down, because Cerinthus, the enemy of truth, is within. So Cerinthus was a problem, an enemy of the truth. From this testimony, we know that Gnostic ideals were established as a philosophy before the end of the first century, and that they were seen as opposing the truth taught by the apostles. And before we end, we'll look at a few scriptures that deal with that. So we see Gnosticism was a big influence, and was a very powerful influence and affected the New Testament. Now, what I'd like to focus on here is, you know, you think about this. You know, God said, you look at these Nag Hammadi library. Now, why was it buried? The scholars think that it was buried because the Archbishop of Alexandria basically was telling them that this was heretical and putting pressure on them, so they hid these documents, and they've come to the light of day here in our time. Now, let's think about some scriptures that deal with Gnosticism, and it'll give you a little bit of insight into what Gnosticism is about. Let's go to, if you look at the book of 1 John, it's filled with statements that are made, and John was dealing with Gnosticism. Remember, he dealt with this Gnostic philosopher, teacher named Cerinthus. And so he has to address these issues to the church in 1 John, beginning in chapter 1. And as you understand some things about Gnosticism, you can understand why John says what he says. As you look at 1 John chapter 1, verse 1, it says, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and our hands have handled concerning the word of life. Now, why does he begin that way? He's telling you that this being that he's talking about here, who is Jesus Christ, he begins like he does the book of John. In the beginning, there's this being that existed. And he came into the physical world, and they saw him, they touched him, they heard him, and he was a human being. But he was of divine origin. So he was God, and he was man. The life was manifested, and we have seen and bear witness and declare to you that eternal life, which was with the Father and was manifested to us, so he was eternal. And then came into the physical world. Now, you see, that's a problem for the Gnostics, because the physical world is evil. And God's not going to have anything to do with the physical world. So you start doing all this philosophical stuff in order to, well, how could this be then? And you come, you know, they came up with the idea like Christ was some sort of a created being. And he was the one. He was evil and brought the physical world into being. Does that sound like a blasphemous statement? I think so. But that's some of the stuff they came up with. And some people felt that Christ was here in the flesh. He was a physical being, but when he was on the cross, the Spirit left. He was just inhabiting this body. Okay? But he really wasn't here. He really wasn't part of this physical world. Well, that's not what it says at all. It says, that which we have seen and heard, we declare to you, that you also may have fellowship with us. And truly, our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ. The Father and Jesus Christ are beings with whom we have fellowship. Jesus Christ isn't some evil being. And these things we write to you, that your joy may be full. And the reason that John is writing from this perspective, right from the get-go in the book, is because he's addressing Gnostic ideas. We go to 1 John 1, verse 8. 1 John 1, verse 8, it says, if we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. For the Gnostic, it didn't matter what you did. You're physical. And because you have this insight, it doesn't matter what you do in this physical world, you're going back to heaven or wherever it is you go. And so, I don't have sin. Sin's irrelevant. And that was something they had to deal with. And John said, sin is very relevant. You have to acknowledge your sin. And if you don't acknowledge your sin, then you've got a problem. You're deceiving yourself. And the truth isn't in us. Chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. Chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. He says, now by this we know that we know him, if we keep his commandments. He who says, I know him, and does not keep his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. So if you say you know God, then you should be keeping the commandments. That's not a Gnostic principle at all. You go to verse 9. He who says he is in the light and hates his brother is in darkness until now. So the Gnostics said they were in the light, but they didn't have to love their brother. That was, again, physical, irrelevant. So I'm spiritually on a higher plane than you. I'm superior to you. And you don't have insight. I do. And I can look down on them. I can disdain them. And he says, you know, if you say you're in the light and you hate your brother, you're in darkness. He who loves his brother abides in the light, and there is no cause for stumbling in him. But he who hates his brother is in darkness and walks in darkness and does not know where he is going because the darkness has blinded his eyes. So he's addressing these philosophies. And some people, as they endorse this Gnostic philosophy, what would they do? They would be involved in immorality to prove that the flesh was irrelevant. Now, they weren't all doing that, but that's where their philosophy took them sometimes. Finally, let's look at 1 John chapter 4, verse 3. It says, and every spirit that does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God. And this is the spirit of Antichrist, which you have heard was coming and is now already in the world. So they said that Jesus Christ did not come in the flesh. Because how could God, who is pure, have anything to do with flesh, which is evil? And he said, sorry, Christ came in the flesh. Flesh is not inherently evil. Otherwise, how could God say it's good? Flesh, in and of itself, there's nothing wrong with it. It's what the flesh does that's the problem. So you see, John and Paul and the apostles had to address these issues because they were undermining the true faith. And what Dan Brown is doing in the Da Vinci Code is saying these Gnostic Gospels are superior to what the Bible is teaching you. Does that sound Gnostic? It certainly does. And where are you going otherwise? Now, it says it's interesting, these supposed crucial books to our understanding of Jesus Christ and true religion were hidden for close to 2,000 years. Now stop and think about that. If God is interested in you being a part of His family, He's going to allow these books to be hidden for 1,500 years or 2,000 years? Why would he do that? Well, he didn't do that. As you look at, let's go to Romans chapter 3. Romans chapter 3. Romans chapter 3. And look at verses 1 and 2. What advantage then has the Jew? Or what is the profit of circumcision? Much in every way. Chiefly because to them were committed the oracles of God, what we know as the Scriptures. God used the Jews to preserve His Word and to bring it down to the New Testament church. That was passed along to the New Testament church. And then God ensured, just as He had in preserving the New Testament, He said, I want some additional things added. And He inspired the Gospels. He inspired the other pastoral writings, the apostolic writings, which have all come down to us in the Bible as we know it today. And so is God capable of preserving those things? I think so. So you have the Dead Sea Scrolls. They're interesting. They're historical. And they offer us some insight about the world at the time of Jesus Christ. And they also back up the fact that God preserved the Old Testament. And you have the Nag Hammadi Library. All it is irrelevant. It means nothing to us as Christians. And people that try to tell you that there are these lost Gospels, that's nonsense. There were no lost Gospels. Otherwise, you say, God, how'd you lose those books for 2,000 years? He didn't. So as people try to tell you there are lost Gospels, you can say, sorry, nothing's been lost. There are four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And those Bibles are preserved for us. Those books are preserved for us and allow us to be able to understand God's way of life and the other books that are a part of it. So these writings are interesting, but you have to realize that they're not crucial to our salvation in any way. So hopefully that gives you a little bit more understanding of the books we know as the Dead Sea Scrolls and the so-called Gnostic Gospels, and hopefully that'll give you some underpinnings for why we believe the Bible is sufficient for instructing us in everything that we need for eternal life. So, I have my hour, and you have the rest of the Sabbath day. Still looks pretty nice out there, so enjoy the day and have a most wonderful week and a safe week, and we'll look forward to seeing you next Sabbath.